Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for the Tech Guy is provided by CacheFly. CacheFly.com. Hi, this is Leo Laporte, and this is my Tech Guy podcast. This show originally aired on the Premier Networks on Sunday, August 17th, 2014. This is episode 1110. Enjoy. The Tech Guy podcast is brought to you by ShareFile. Enhance your workflow. Send files of almost any size easily and securely with Citrix ShareFile. Try ShareFile today for a 30-day free trial. Go to ShareFile.com, click the microphone, and enter Tech Guy. And by Gazelle, the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. Find out what your used iPhone, iPad, or other Apple product is worth at Gazelle.com. Well, hey, how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the Tech Guy, and it's time to talk tech. Computers, the internet, home theater, cell phones, MP3 players. No, I guess we probably won't talk about them. We talked about headphones yesterday. That's kind of like MP3 players. 8888 Ask Leo is the phone number. If you have a question, a comment, a suggestion, you want to talk high tech, that's what I'm here for. 888-827-5536. Toll free from anywhere in the U.S. or Canada. And you can also use Skype to reach us. If you use Skype out, you can call us from anywhere in the world at no expense to you. I thought this was funny in the news this week. Facebook has decided that those of us who use Facebook perhaps don't always recognize the satirical nature of articles posted on Facebook, particularly from The Onion. And you must have seen, we've all seen this, somebody posts an article that's a joke as if it were true. So Facebook's got a new feature. They're tagging some stories as satire, just in case you were confused. Part of this goes back to the fact that people don't read the stuff they share. Isn't that the case? You see the headline, you say, oh, that's got to be good, everybody. Because you're in such a hurry to get some stuff on the news feed, get some stuff sharing. You just go, oh, yeah, I'll share that. And there you go. You may not have noticed when you read it that the article was completely crazy. We're running a small test, said Facebook. They told Ars Technica, the tech blog, which shows the text satire in front of links to satirical articles. In the related articles in the newsfeed, just so you don't feel like, you know, maybe that you're going to... For instance, here's one that's often relinked, not just The Onion. New Yorker magazine has a really funny humor column by a guy named Andy Borowitz. But Andy really likes to skate close to the truth, you know, and so it sometimes seems true. And it fools people. They call it the Borowitz problem. it's the shouts. So if you see something from the New Yorker shouts and murmurs column, that's comedy. That ain't serious. You'll see people retweet, for instance, his humor piece called "Millionaires Unite to Defeat Minimum Wage," but it sounds so plausible that you might. You might believe it. So good on Facebook for making this all very clear to us. We won't be fooled anymore, as the kids used to say. Look for the satire tag in a feed near you. Somebody in Thailand, secretary of the National Telecommunications Commission in Thailand, their equivalent of the FCC, tweeted, yes, we've approved the new iPhone. Whoops. Takorn Tantasith earlier this week tweeted, approval for the two new iPhone 6 models, the A1586 and the A1524. That's all. We didn't see anything but the product name and model numbers. However, my goodness, it's the first time a product approval has been tweeted by the secretary of the NBTC. So Apple decided they're not too happy, and they just requested a meeting to discuss the situation. It's kind of like being called into the principal's office. We'd like you to come in, sir, and discuss this with you. The National Telecommunications Commission's Secretary General said everything was done according to protocol. On August 8th, the NTBC has approved two new phone models. This disclosure is not a trade secret. And so tweeting it was okay, except he'd never tweeted it before, anything like that. I think, like everybody else, he was sucked up in the Apple mania, wanted to be the first to let everybody know. Interesting, there will be two models. That does not mean, the rumors we've heard, of course, are that there are, this is the year, every other year Apple does a big redesign. This is the year for the big redesign. And I think everybody seems to agree. All the rumor sites seem to agree. There will be a larger iPhone, 4.7 inches, compared to the 4-inch iPhone 5S and 5, for that matter, and 5C, for that matter. There had been rumors about a 5.5-inch iPhone, two models. Now, just because they're saying two models here doesn't mean there are two models. Sometimes what Apple does is releases maybe something like the 5S as, you know, a new version of the 5S for this year, something like that. But we'll watch. Maybe there will be two new iPhones, one big, one bigger. That would be nice. A couple of anniversaries we celebrated this week. It was on August 12th in 1981 that IBM released the IBM PC, the 5150. It was very expensive. Did not come with a floppy disk drive, let alone a hard drive. It came with a cassette port, and you could add an optional cassette adapter. It was a 4.77 megahertz processor. And it was on this day, also August, or that day, August 12th, same day, 6 days ago, whatever it is. My math isn't quite right. 5 days ago. In 2004, that Adam Curry released his first podcast. Not the first podcast ever. There have been others before that. Chris Lydon had done one a couple of years earlier while he was at Harvard. But it really was the first podcast. And I think we can say podcasting began 10 years ago this week. The IBM PC, 33 years ago this week. A couple of momentous birthdays. Happy birthday. Twitter says 23 million of its active users are bots. But that's not bad. Those are things that are tweeting kind of automatically. And there are quite a few of these. You know, a bridge that says, well, the traffic's good. Or, you know, a parking lot that says I'm full. I think those are good. I subscribe to a lot of automatic tweeting machines. Not a bad thing. Quite a few of them, though. 23 million of them. Wow. 8888 Ask Leo. We could talk about anything in your tech life, anything that's working well or not working at all. 888-827-5536. The website is techguylabs.com. Good place to go if you want to get links to anything I mention or articles, but also a good place to get the answers to the questions people ask. Read those answers, listen to them, and watch them. We put audio and video up a couple of days after the show. Not exactly a podcast. We also do a podcast you can subscribe to, all of that for free. And one of the things I really like is if you comment, if you read something you don't like, you can comment on that, on any of the questions. We divide the page up into days, episodes, hours. So you can just go right into an episode, right into an hour. And episode 1110, this episode is in progress right now. It's a work in progress, but you can comment as the questions come in. And yeah, we don't charge for that. No subscription fee. We don't even ask your email or anything like that. It's all free. TechGuyLabs.com. Lately, I've been recommending the Chromebook quite a bit. I'm excited about a new Chromebook that's due out soon from NVIDIA. That will be the fastest Chromebook out there with 4 gigs of memory. Compare this to the IBM PC 33 years ago. This Chromebook costs $279 compared to the almost $3,000 IBM PC. Has 4, I think they're 2 gigahertz processors compared to the single 4.77 megahertz processor of the IBM PC. 13-inch screen, but it comes with the computer that didn't come with the IBM PC in those days. It's kind of amazing progress we've made. 8888-ASK. Leo, let's talk. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. The Beatles, 8 days a week. That is, I'm told, by Heather Hammond, who was there. How Paul McCartney began his concert at Candlestick Park on Thursday. The last event at the rundown old place where the Giants used to play and the Niners used to play. They've both moved on. Niners, in fact, have their first game at their new stadium in Santa Clara today. And you were there. You saw Paul McCartney. And this is how he began the concert with 8 days a week.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty cool.
It was great. Everything was amazing.
Oh.
But yeah, true to form, Candlestick was quite cold. We were worried about his fingers. You know, he's strumming and playing piano out in that cold.
That was the that's the ballpark where a pitcher got blown off the mound by the wind in a Giants game.
It's so absurd. I need to study weather. Like, it'll be, it's colder, you know, inside the walls than it is outside or something. Like, it's a vortex.
It is. There's a polar vortex inside the stadium.
Do you know, I had a Burberry poncho on with fur collar and the hood up and everything.
That's good, because I'm sure it was freezing. Meanwhile, it's 80 degrees right now at the new stadium, and it will be 80 throughout the entire game, so.
Yeah,
so that's an improvement, I think. And, you know, it's right in the heart of Silicon Valley now. You look out the, you know, from the stands, it's an open stadium, and you'll see many of the big companies, including Google's right there, Great America, the amusement park's next door. We get bored by the game. That's what Lisa's playing. Lisa's there. She's there with her son, Michael. That's what she's planning. She's, you know, she's a preseason game. She says, after the first quarter, we're going across the street to Great America.
To the Tilt-A-Whirl.
They're going to get on the Tilt-A-Whirl.
Oh, my God.
Oh, my goodness.
Are they going to have to change the 49ers' names to something like the Chips?
Well, you know, there's been some question. You're going to keep the San Francisco name. You're playing now, you know, 50 miles south of San Francisco. They say, yeah, we're going to keep the name. But it's won't be too long. Levi's has the naming rights to the stadium, so we'll call it Levi's Stadium. That'll be interesting. I have a friend, Norman Maslov, who's a Beatleologist, who was at the 1964 performance of the Beatles at Candlestick Park. It was something like 40 minutes, not even that long. It was very quick.
Right.
Yeah, and
yeah,
you couldn't
I
hear
heard
a thing.
Half hour. Right.
Yeah, you couldn't hear a thing. They're screaming. And Dr. Mom is sending me YouTube video. This is the amazing. We live in an amazing time. The YouTube video of the pitcher falling off the mound.
Oh, great.
We live in an amazing world where you can you can say, oh, yeah, back in, it was Stu Miller got blown off the mound, and back in, when was that? Years ago. And you can find it. You can actually find it on the internet. So let's find a caller. What do you say?
Yes, Sam in San Diego.
Sam and... that's hard to say. Sam in San Diego. Oh, I just hung up. Wait a minute. Oh, boy. I pushed too many buttons.
We got overexcited.
What happened?
Well, let's make it Victor in Anaheim, then.
It was already picked up. Hi, Victor. Sam, call back. I'm so sorry. Hi, Victor. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
How are you there, Leo?
Okay,
hey, here's
Victor.
My question.
Yeah.
How many internet addresses are in IP version 6?
A lot. More than you have to ever worry about. So this is actually an interesting question. I've talked to the man who came up with this system many moons ago, Vince Cerf, and he's been lobbying ever since to increase the number. When we first, you know, every computer on the internet has its own unique internet address. It's a dotted quad that is from 0 to 255, 0 to 255, 0 to 255, etc. Those original, we thought those original IP version 4 addresses would be more than enough to accommodate the few hundred thousand computers that even the most optimistic people thought, well, there'd never be more than that on the internet. But we've run out. We didn't run out as fast as we ought to have because many of us are behind what we call NAT routers. So if you have four computers, you know, an iPad, an iPhone, and a laptop, and a desktop hooked up to your router at home, you still only need one address for all four of those, thanks to network address translation. So the address space for the IPv4 is, there's 32 bits, so it's 2 to the 32th, whatever that is. And then we're now going to go to, what is it, eight blocks, a dotted 8? So that would be more. Do you know? I figure you know if you're asking me.
I'll tell you what I think I know. I remember I worked in the communications industry, and I remember reading about an iteration before it became the standard that it is now, and it's 128 bit. I looked it up on Wikipedia.
Right. So it's 2 to the 128th, right?
Yep, and then I looked up the size of the world on Wikipedia.
It's bigger than that.
And then a programmer helped me in a chat room figure it out, the calculations. It turns out that it's enough internet addresses to cover the entire world, an entire blanket of sand all over the entire world. That's pretty darn thick, and it's more than Carl Sagan said is in the Milky Way galaxy as far as stars go.
Every star and every planet could have its own internet address under this new scheme. So we think we won't run out, but as always, it's always mind-boggling. The reason this is important is because eventually we'd like to put everything on the internet with its own address. If your thermostat is network addressable and your refrigerator and your garage opener and so forth, that would be great. Unfortunately, we're still pretty much stuck with IP version 4. Moving to the next version, although there is a need, we are running out of addresses. In fact, in some cases, we've run out. But we're finding other solutions to solve the problem because we don't want to spend all the money, including your router. Many routers would have to be upgraded. Of course, your internet service provider would have to upgrade. It would be a very challenging technical end task and very expensive. So right now, 96% of traffic worldwide is still on the old system, IPv4. Even though we're running out of addresses. That may continue for a while. There's some hacks, something called carrier NAT, that your internet service provider can use to reduce the number of addresses they need and so forth. But it is an issue. So the new IPv6 will be 8 groups. Instead of separated by dots, you'll notice it because it looks different. They'll be separated by colons. 8 groups of 4 hex digits. It's a big, 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 big number. It's virtually infinite. It's as close to infinite as it can be. But we're still not there. We're still not there. It's kind of an issue. I don't know exactly how it's going to get handled. Vint Cerf is still campaigning. All right, is Sam? Did we get him back? Yeah, let's go back to. I am so sorry. My apologies, Sam. I pushed some weird button and I hung up on a bunch of people.
Apologies accepted.
Thank you for getting back to us.
No problem. Yeah, thank God. Hey, look, I got a question about QR codes. And it goes back to apps here. I was trying to download some apps for the QR codes, and there's so many to choose from.
Yeah.
That can you recommend anything that would be for my iPhone
QR. Yeah, sure. I'll get you a recommendation right after this break. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Our show today brought to you by something that really changed my life when it was time to share files with the radio stations, commercials and bumpers and things like that. I used to use a well-known other third-party sharing mechanism that just was a problem. For a while, I used one that required the other guy to sign up for an account. That wasn't going to work. You can't get them to do that. Then I started using one that allowed the other guy to delete the file when he was done with it, which meant that the other stations didn't get it. Fortunately, it was right about then that I found ShareFile. Citrix ShareFile changed my life. It is now so easy to share files easily, quickly, and very importantly, securely. Nowadays, you've heard me said many times, do not send email attachments. That is unsafe. The attachments are visible on the internet. It's like sending a postcard. If you're doing this for business, you really need Citrix ShareFile, designed by business for business for sending and receiving and sharing files. First of all, you don't get bounce backs. You send files of almost any size. It's always under your control. You decide who has access for how long, how many times they can download it. You can password protect for optimal security. You can easily share files and collaborate with others, too. Citrix Share File. And their mobile apps are great. So when I make a, I save all the audio. I have it sync up. You know, they have a background syncing program that runs. They have lots of great tools like that. And then if I forget to share the file, I can do it on my phone. I just go, hey, here's the file. Sorry, I forgot. Many is the time that saved me a trip back to the studio. We've got a 30-day free trial. Sign up for ShareFile right now for a month. Click the link at the top of the page right here where it says podcast listeners right at the top there and use the offer code TECHGUY and we'll get you 30 days free. Make sure you specify the industry because ShareFile can be customized to be compliant with HIPAA, financial regulations from the SEC. Many industries have special requirements and ShareFile will support them all. Citrix ShareFile. Visit ShareFile.com. Click the microphone and enter in TECHGUY. Sam in San Diego wants to read QR codes. Those are those weird squiggles you see now on that, you know, so there's all kinds of machine readable codes on the back of, you know, most cans of food. For instance, there's a bar code, the grocery code. It's just a bunch of bars of differing thickness. You'll see that on mail. You'll see it on, you know, a lot of places. That's a bar code because it looks like a bar. QR codes are kind of square. You'll see them a lot of times on, I don't know, web pages, billboards, ads, that kind of thing. And you can, you know, they're machine readable, right? So, and you know, a lot of times a QR code is merely an address, a URL. And so I'm looking at one right now that came with the Google Cardboard Virtual Reality Kit. And it has underneath it a human readable web address, g.co/cardboard. But if for some reason you just really didn't want to type, you'd take a picture of that squiggle, that weird code. Looks like something out of Space Invaders. And your phone would automatically interpret it and bring you to that page. There are a million free apps for scanning on all platforms. The one I use, and actually I like because it has a little more functionality perhaps than some others, is available from scan.me, the website. And you'll find on scan.me a link to the apps, and they have apps for iOS. They have apps for Android. They make a QR code reader, but they have a more sophisticated scan app as well. Windows Phone, Windows devices, Macintosh, Kindle, everything. And this site, scan.me, will let you make your own QR codes, too, if you want to put them on a web page or, a billboard or whatever. Now, it's $1.99 for the scan app, so if you just want the QR code reader, that's free. Probably all you need, and that's what I use on my phones. But there are lots of them. There's some just called barcode reader that are free. It's a simple thing to do. I wonder why this isn't part of the operating system at this point. Archandra in the chat room is saying QR codes were originally made for car manufacturing. So they put it on a part, and then the machine would scan the part as it was coming down the assembly line. They'd know that what they were getting. It's not a very friendly technology, is it? I don't really like it that much. Sunny in Torrance, California. You're next. Hi, Sunny. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Oh, let me push the button. Hey, Sunny.
Hi, Leo.
What's up?
Well, where I'm at is I have a Apple TV that my daughter gave me several years ago. So it's the second generation.
Oh, yeah.
Never used, never opened, still has a shrink wrap around it. Mm-hmm. And I'm ready to use it now and to realize that there's an upgraded model, the third generation.
Yeah, in fact, I think we might even see a fourth generation this fall.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Well, the question was created by, I thought that I would try to sell it on eBay. And looking at the second generation, I realized that it's 720 on high definition as right. opposed to the current 1080p.
Right.
But I got a surprise by what they're selling for on eBay, a lot of money. Well, this thing new, brand new, was $99 on eBay, they're selling for anywhere from $200 to $300. And I'm finding out that the reason is jailbreaking them. And that I'm the second generation, apparently, can be jailbroke. And the third, either you can't do it or it's much harder to do it.
That's interesting.
So now I'm wondering if I even want to sell it. So the reason for my call and my question to
you
is...
I'd sell it on eBay and take the $200. But okay. Okay.
Well, that's what I'm trying to find out and buy a new one for $100.
Yeah.
Of the 1080p.
Although you might want to wait. I also see buy it now for third generation Apple TVs at $200. I think there are people on eBay who prey on ignorant buyers. And maybe that isn't, you can buy a jailbroken one, and that, I can understand why people are charging more for the jailbroken one.
Right.
Because they did the work, right?
And I guess if you know how to do it, then there's an advantage to buying the not, like mine is brand new. Like I was saying, still in the wrapper. So I have everything. I have the box, the remote. It's never been opened. But and some of them are jailbroken, and the jailbroken ones are the most expensive.
Yeah. Which is silly because it's not hard to jailbreak them.
It's not. No. Well, how do I find out about what it takes to jailbreak them? Is it something that I can do myself? And what is the advantage of having it jailbroken?
I used to jailbreak my Apple TVs. I don't anymore. I think you should consider your Apple TV a sealed box and treat it as such. But if you want to jailbreak it and make it much less reliable, you could do so for $30 from firecore.com. They have compiled together a bunch of open source free programs. If you really want to take the time getting all those programs for free, you can do it. But it's a lot easier just to use Firecore because... it just does it, and it does it quickly and easily. And I've used this for, and it's a lifetime subscription. So, as the Apple TV gets changed and so forth, FireCore gets updated. It's a very easy thing to use. Well, let me see. It doesn't do, as you say, it does not do the third generation, just the first and the second generation. So you're right. You have the last, I guess, hackable or easily hackable. But I really question the need to jailbreak one of these things. It's I don't think you gain a whole lot.
Oh, you don't?
No. Uh-huh. I used to jailbreak the original Apple TV. I had it jailbroken. The problem is it compromises its reliability. Apple TV is an appliance, and I think you should think of it that way.
Got it.
Yeah.
And so FireCore just runs through the it just works like an app.
Yeah, it's a US, you put it on a USB key from your computer. You put the USB key in your Apple TV. You reboot the Apple TV. It automatically inputs it, boots to it, and hacks it.
Wow.
It's very easy to do.
Okay, and that's Apple Core, C-O-R-E?
No, FireCore. It's the easiest way. Since you have a second generation, if you're willing to spend $30, jailbreak it, then you can sell it for $300. It's a good investment.
And that's exactly what's going on. A great investment. I didn't realize what I was sitting on.
Always a risk when you do this kind of thing of bricking it, that is turning it into a useless piece of plastic. But it's a low risk. FireCore is pretty well, it's been around for a long time. I've used it many times. I think it's
Have you heard anything about the new generation, the fourth generation that's coming up?
It's speculation because Apple has not announced it, but I do feel that they will announce this year a new Apple TV that will have considerable advances in capabilities. That's why they went from the second generation to the third generation. You nailed it. They went from 720p to 1080p. There's a lot more they could do. They could go to 4K. There's a lot more they could do with their Apple TV. I think it's a great appliance. But at $99, I don't see any real point in hacking it. I guess sometimes people like to take a video from their computer and put it on a USB key, plug it into the Apple TV, play it back, things like that.
I see. Well, I was just seeing screens that they were showing on eBay, and it was showing Hulu, and that you're getting Hulu and Netflix and things like that.
Well, Hulu and Netflix are already on the Apple TV.
That's why I was assuming that there was not a charge, that you're bypassed.
Well, that would be highly illegal, and one could not advocate that for sure. I know free Hulu or free Netflix would be stealing it, just like stealing your cable connection. I wouldn't recommend that. Look at Apple TV Flash at firecore.com. That'll tell you what it can do. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. dedicate this to the folks at OnePlus, the makers of the OnePlus One phone, who had to retire their marketing campaign. They said, this one's for the ladies. You can't do that anymore. This one's for the ladies. It's a great phone, and it's kind of sad that this company seems so boneheaded in their marketing for this phone. The OnePlus One phone is a very high-end flagship Android phone, which I use. I love. But you can't buy it very easily. There is a store, a Chinese store. Somebody sent me the link to a Chinese store where you can buy it. I'm not going to recommend that on the air, but you can buy it. The thing about this phone is it's high-end in every respect, 5.5 inches, beautiful screen, really nice software because they're using CyanogenMod, which is a third-party firmware a lot of people put on their phones anyway. Comes with it. Great camera. And it's $300 out the door unlocked. It's like half the cost of a Galaxy S5, and it's better. $350, you get 64 gigs of RAM, of memory, 3 gigs of RAM. It's a nice phone. But you cannot just go to OnePlus.net, the company, and buy it. You have to get an invitation or play a contest. So you can get an invitation from somebody who's already bought one. Not me, because I got mine from somebody else's that he wasn't going to buy. It's complicated, but I didn't get an invitation. Somebody just sold me his. So don't ask me for invitations. I don't have any invitations. Or you could play a contest. Now, their first contest was a horrible car wreck. They said, send us a video of you smashing your old phone and we'll give you an invitation to buy the new one. Well, a lot of people pointed out that's quite a waste. First of all, there's pretty much, you give this phone to somebody, you could sell it. Pretty much anything besides smashing it would be a better thing to do. So the company retracted, recanted, said, oh, don't smash it. Never mind. Forget we mentioned that. Most recently, this week, they said, ladies, we want to jump you up to the front of the line. This is skeezy. All you have to do is send us a picture of yourself with the OnePlus logo on your body, and we'll put it on the forums and let the forums rate you, and then the most highly rated ladies will get an invitation. Yeah, shaking S, as the kids say, SMH, shake my head. Now, I talked with one of our editors here, Tony Wang. He's from Taiwan, as is this company. And he said, it may be a cultural thing because it's very common. You see this at car shows and everywhere, that people put company logos on their cheeks, on their arms, on their hands. It's not at all uncommon. And it may be that this Taiwanese company, not understanding the implication of asking the ladies to do it and having the forums vote on it, maybe they just thought they'd put them on their hands. But obviously, that's not what happened. And, of course, they've retracted this entire plan. So I want to dedicate the Commodore's Brick House to OnePlus. Go back to the 80s, guys. Try again. Anyway, it's a nice phone. But my friend Gina Trapani, who loves this phone, she was the founder of Lifehacker, the Lifehacker blog, and is a Android developer. She's host of one of our shows about Android, all about Android. And she says, I'm thinking of sending the thing back. I love the phone, but I don't want to be participating in a company that treats women like that. I don't blame them. And you got to wonder, what is this company up to? I mean, why? What are they going to sell it at some point? What's the story, guys? It's been months now. 8888 Ask Leo, that's the phone number. There are better phones coming, and I wouldn't probably jump through hoops to get a OnePlus. I'm very excited. I think Motorola/Google, because Google still owns Motorola. Lenovo hasn't taken over yet. They're going to release the next generation of my favorite Android phone, the Moto X, I think September 4th. They have an event coming up. And it's expected that they'll announce the new Moto 360 wristwatch, which will be an Android watch with a round face and its companion piece, which would be the Moto X Plus One or whatever they call it. That, I think, is going to be a phone to watch. It was great in its first edition with a few little minor flaws, not a great camera. Screen wasn't very high resolution. It was only 720p. I'd like to see a higher res screen, maybe a little bigger. I bet you Motorola fixes that. And so September 4th, watch that. Of course, September 9th, as I mentioned, Apple will announce its new phone. The Galaxy Note 4 should be coming out sometime soon, perhaps at IFA, which is also in early September. That's the big Berlin Consumer Electronics Show, IFA. In fact, we're probably going to see a few new phones at IFA, IFA. So probably no reason to embroider your face with the OnePlus logo in order to get an invitation. By the way, you don't get a free phone. You get the right to buy a phone at full price. It's not even like you get a free phone. They think quite highly of themselves, don't they? Eleanor in Pasadena. Hi, Eleanor.
Hi, Leo. Thanks for taking my call.
Of course. What can I do for
you? I have an original iPad, right? The old first one.
Wow. Good for you.
And I don't use it really for anything other than just kind of scrolling the web and responding to email. But when I'm scrolling on the web, I'll be in the middle of reading an article, and it will crash and take me back to the home screen.
Oh, I hate that. And that's Safari crashing.
Yeah. It makes me crazy.
Well, that thing is 4 years old now. It's possible that over time it's become a little corrupted. The best thing you could do is to start over with the thing.
Okay.
You know, get it back to the way it was. And this is actually...
Well, I cleared the history and cleared the cache and tried to reset, and it still does it.
Yeah. And those are thank you, because those are the first things you should do, because those are the easy ones. But if it doesn't work, then you can literally get the iPad back to the condition it was when it came from the factory.
Okay.
And you would do that with iTunes on a Windows or a Mac.
Okay.
You want to restore it to factory settings. And,
okay.
And that, now, that's going to help. Here's the problem. That original iPad had very scant memory. It only had 256 megabytes of memory. If you have a lot of tabs, do you use tabs? Do you have a lot of pages open?
No, I don't.
Okay. That may crash it just when, because Safari uses a lot of memory. Web pages these days are huge. And that's something that's changed a little bit in the last 4 years. So it may be that the original iPad from 4 years ago didn't really expect these giant web pages. I think that probably the best thing to do is restore it to factory settings. You do that from iTunes while it's plugged into your computer.
Okay.
And then before you do that, back up. Then try Safari, see if everything's working. And if it is, then you could try restoring, but you may be restoring the problem.
Okay.
But you know what? This takes no time. It's very quick. So
yeah.
It's worth it. It's worth a try. If Safari continues to crash even after a factory reset, then it may really be that just the lack of memory is causing these websites to crash the page. And that can happen. But first thing, that you've cleared the history, you cleared the cache, now it's time to reset the iPad. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Well, hey, how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the tech guy. Time to talk about computers, the internet, cell phones, home theater, all that jazz. Anything with a chip in it. Digital photography coming up in about half an hour with our photo guy, Chris Marquardt. 8888-ASK-LEO is the phone number, 888-827-5536. Toll free from anywhere in the U.S. or Canada. We were talking before the break about an iPad first generation. And it's only 4 years old. The iPad was introduced January 2010. Started shipping by the summer of that year. So our caller's iPad, you know, no more than 4 years old. And yet, for some reason with tablets, that sounds like a long time. And mostly it's because we've made so much progress over the last 4 years. But really, there should be nothing wrong with that machine. A four-year-old computer is practically new. Four-year-old car, still in great shape. Four-year-old TV, fine. And I'm sure most of the appliances in my home are many, many more than 4 years old. And yet somehow with an iPad, 4 years is a lifetime. And I think Apple wants it that way. Although note that iPad sales have plummeted over the last two quarters. And the conventional wisdom is everybody who wants an iPad has an iPad. And there's not a lot of incentive to get a new one. Now, if you have an iPad 1, 2, or 3, you probably should get a new one. When the iPads went high res, went Retina, starting with, was that the fourth generation iPad? I think it was. Maybe it was the third. Yeah, it was the third. The problem with the third generation iPad is it had very high resolution display, but not enough processor power to support it, so it was a little sluggish. So I would say a fourth generation iPad or later is pretty much fine. Now, there'll be a new iPad and a new iOS in October, probably. And the challenge for Apple is just to do something with the new iPad that makes you want to get rid of your old iPad. However, I think if you have an iPad 1, it might be time to look at a new one. You've got a good run out of that iPad 1. It's a way of technology, unfortunately, especially brand new technology. PCs are so mature now that there's not a lot of impetus to get a new computer. But tablets, they've made some great strides in 4 years. Tom's on the line from Warren, Ohio, our next caller. Hi, Tom. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hi, Leo. How you doing,
Seth? I'm well. How are you?
I'm well. Yeah, you would be a little bit better if you were at the football game, though, eh?
You know, it's preseason. I can live with that.
Yeah.
My girlfriend's there. Lisa's there. She's having a great time. She's enjoying it. I'm seeing pictures of her seats, and it looks like a beautiful day in Santa Clara.
I heard the first event over there was the soccer game. There was terrible traffic. How was the traffic down there?
Yeah, I don't know yet. I'm sure I'll hear some tales of woe from Lisa at the end of the day. She, you know what? Heather Hammond's a traffic reporter. We should ask her.
Yeah.
Let's go to our eye in the sky.
Direct traffic.
Heather Hammond.
Looks good.
The problem was, correct me if I'm wrong, I don't think they built enough parking. I don't think they have any parking. They're using the existing parking in the area around it, and that's always going to be a problem. And then I remember reading from one reporter from the San Francisco Chronicle who went to the soccer game, which was, by the way, a lot fewer people than will be there today, and certainly many, many fewer than will be there on opening day. And one of the problems was you could take the train, the Caltrain there, but you had to get to the train station, you had to cross the tracks. So they had to shut down the train frequently as people walked across the tracks from the stadium. This is not a good design.
Did you get, Lisa, the Levi's Stadium mobile app?
Yeah, I'm sure she has it. She brought her iPad. Yeah, you can order food from, I mean, you know.
Yeah, order food, yeah, find out where the restrooms are, how long the wait in line is.
I like that. How long is the wait in line? You can tell how long the wait in line for the restroom is?
I don't know about that, but I think.
Now that I could use.
Yeah. Oh, yes, for the women's room, there's always a line.
Now, you're in Warren, Ohio, so are you a Browns fan? What's your team?
Yeah, sir, you got that right. We're Johnny Football and the Browns over there. They're playing Monday night, and the last Browns game, they had a record rating for a preseason
awesome
game.
You know, I have to say, I'm glad the NFL is only 16 weeks because it would really eat into my life if we're all year round.
Oh, yes.
But I do look forward to it.
Anything done.
It feels like fall is on its way when you start seeing the players take the field.
Right.
What can I do for you?
We're looking at, and I'm digging into it now. I'm on a Google forum. I'm looking it up, and there's a bunch of other people inquiring about it. The format for a digital image, it's .KQP. You ever hear of that? And I'm trying to get it converted off these old floppies.
Was it a Kodak camera?
I've seen some people in the forum say that they had it on Kodak, but this is Konica Picture Show.
Yeah, Konica Quality Picture, KQP, yeah.
Oh, is that what that was?
Yeah, so.
And I don't know if you have a file converter that you could recommend for that. I've got, I got about a dozen floppies over here I need to get pictures off of.
Well, I'm going to point you to a website that's a useful website when this comes up called openwith.org.
I got my pen right here.
Yeah, open with, as in, what do you open this with? Openwith.org, and you can search for an extension and maybe get some help figuring out how to open it. I should type in KQP and see if they have anything for this. Images, yeah, look, they do. Look at that. Images generally are, even though the file format may be odd, they should be pretty accessible because they're either a plain old bitmap, and if you could find a bitmap within the file, then you can just create an image out of it, or they're compressed, and there are only a few well-known ways for compressing it. Turns out there's a program called XNView. XNView com that can open KQP images, at least according to the website. The good news is it's free. They have it for Windows, Mac, and Linux. That's good news. XNVIEW.com. And it's a handy thing. Keep that around if you've got old floppies. First, you got to get a floppy drive. But openwith.org is a very handy little resource for people who have files that they can't figure out how to open. Good luck, Tom. Let me know if it works. And get them off the floppy, because any recording media that is, you know, like a floppy, which is reel-to-reel tape, diskettes, you know, the way they work is you've got a plastic substrata, mylar often, with iron, some sort of iron oxide on it. And that's how it records. The heads are magnetic, and they change the polarity of the iron oxide according to ones and zeros. That stuff flakes off the mylar after 10 years, and it really becomes hard to read. People with old reel-to-reel tapes might notice this. The tapes start flaking. Sometimes they bake them first. Baking sometimes refuses it, but it only does it temporarily. And generally, you only get one chance. You bake them. You play them back through your reel-to-reel into a computer, and you're done. That tape now will fall apart. So this is the time. There's a lot of floppies out there that are 10, 20, I suppose, even 30 years old. As we mentioned, the IBM PC is 33 years old this week. So there are probably people with floppy disks that are 30 years old and older. Maybe you had a PDP-8 running giant 8-inch floppies. Those are probably gone. Those are probably gone. The irony is that this image on this floppy, this KQP image, you know, a floppy disk drive, the biggest they got was 1.44 megabytes. It would take, for the images coming out of my high-end digital camera today, 40 floppy disks for one picture. So floppy wasn't really going to last in that storage of pictures. Shell on the line from San Gabriel, California. Hi, Shell.
Hi.
Hi.
I want an internet provider.
Okay, hold on a sec. I hear the music. We got to take a break. We'll be back with more. Your call next. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Wow. 8888 Ask Leo. Shell's on the line from San Gabriel. Sorry I had to put you on hold, Shell. We had to go to the commercial break, but welcome back. Thanks for your patience. What can I do for you?
That's okay. Thank you for taking my call.
Of course, of course.
I'm looking for an internet provider for basically my home, but also on the go for like a tablet. So I don't know if you have any suggestions.
Yeah, usually that's two different internet providers because one's mobile, right? As you go out and about. So it's usually that internet comes from a cell phone provider, Verizon, AT&T, T-Mobile, Sprint, or the like. Your home internet, usually in the U.S., 86% of us in the U.S. have two choices and only two, the phone company or the cable company. Those are the two companies who have put big fat pipes into the house, the cable company with a big cable line and the phone company with the copper pair for phone. Generally speaking, and this really varies depending on how it's implemented, cable is faster because they have more, their pipe is fatter, so they can go faster. DSL may, which is through the phone lines, that's what they call it, DSL, digital subscriber line, that may be, it will be slower, but it may be more consistent because, and again, this depends very much on how it's implemented. The way cable works is your neighborhood gets a certain amount of internet to share. If you've got some bandwidth hogs in the neighborhood, that's going to impact your performance. The way the phone company works, the internet, the entire internet capability of the phone company goes to every subscriber, is divided up among every subscriber. Now, that doesn't mean cable's necessarily worse than DSL. It can be quite the opposite. If the phone company in your area doesn't have enough bandwidth for everybody who's using it, it'll be bad. And if the cable company has more than enough, it'll be good. So those are very big generalities. Who's your cable company?
You know, I don't really know. I know there's a Verizon in the area, and some people have, what's the
Fios?
Cable company?
Comcast, Time Warner, Charter.
Charter. I know a lot of people have Charter, but I don't know.
Yeah, like, so if your neighbors have Charter, that's what's available to you because it's by region. They have a regional monopoly. So if you have Verizon as your cell phone company, if they've put Fios, fiber, into your neighborhood, that could be a good thing. That's probably the fastest connection available to you, but you'll have to ask. One thing people can do is they can go to broadbandreports.com. This is an independent website that tells you who's available in your neighborhood and then gives you reviews on that provider. So if you're starting from scratch, and it sounds like you are, Shell, that probably the first place to go is go and see, enter your zip code and see who offers internet service in your area. And they'll give you reviews of each of those too. So you can see, and you may even see some oddball ones, some wireless, you'll see maybe some satellite. If you have cable or DSL, I would go with those. If you have Fios, I would go with that. You're going to use Verizon or AT&T probably as your mobile connection for your tablet and the like. And again, you can go to broadbandreports.com and look at the reviews for those providers. It's very regional. So somebody who's good in your neighborhood might be bad in another neighborhood. It's very regional. So you really want to check. And it's nice to look at the reviews. Broadbandreports.com. Actually, it will lead you to DSLReports.com, but they don't like to use that name because, frankly, it isn't just DSL anymore. It's all kinds of broadband. And I think we all have to kind of rely on these kinds of community sites to get a sense of how internet access is going to be. The other thing you could do, Shell, is you go, if you've just moved there, go around and meet your neighbors. And in the process of saying hi and I'm new in the neighborhood, and they say welcome, you might ask them, hey, who's the best internet provider? Are you happy with your internet provider? Who's the best phone company in this area? Are you happy with your phone company? That's probably the best way to do it because it is so regional, so local to your neighborhood. I could say, well, my cable company, which is Comcast, the biggest, is very good in my neighborhood, and it might be really terrible in your neighborhood. It really has more to do with anything, how they're implementing it. The choice of your mobile provider, if you have a... Well, it's going to vary. If you have a tablet, that's one thing. If you have a smartphone, it's another. If you already have a cell phone carrier, you probably can go to their store and say, hey, I want to add a tablet. And for $20 or $30 a month, they'll give you internet access on that thing. They'll add it to your existing account. If you don't have an account or you want to change providers, shop around. There are tablets. You can buy tablets that have T-Mobile support and will give you 200 megabytes a month free forever. Now, that's only 200 megabytes, which isn't very much. It might be enough just to do some simple email. It's definitely not enough to surf the web because pages are big these days. But, hey, 200 megabytes free, it gives you a little bit. And T-Mobile's pretty affordable. So there's some good choices for you. But I would start by visiting broadbandreports.com or dslreports.com and get their take on what's best in your neighborhood. There are a lot of phony review sites that are paid for by the companies that they're reviewing. Be very leery of those. I trust DSLReports.com. They've been around for years and years and years, and I consider them reliable. They've been around since 1999, but there are a lot of sites that are really just ads disguised as editorial. This is a big problem right now, by the way, huge problem. They call it native advertising. Maybe you saw John Oliver's piece on it on his HBO show. Native advertising is designed to trick you. It's an ad that sounds like content. And it is an epidemic on the internet. And it's something, boy, we got to teach our kids, we got to teach ourselves how to detect. Because it's really created a problem on the internet where you just don't know if what you're reading is actually reliable, informed opinion or a paid advertisement. And this is the case with these websites. A lot of these websites that review broadband providers are really just thinly disguised ads for a particular provider. It's really a shame. This native advertising is everywhere. We do not do it. I hope you understand when I go to an ad, it's clearly an ad. When I give you an opinion, as I am right now, it's my opinion based on an informed, long-time observer of the field. I consider my integrity unassailable. I don't buy tech stocks. I'm not paid by any company. So when I tell you I like something, it's just because I like it. And when you hear an ad, that's an ad. And you understand that that's a paid thing. It's where they blend the two, and it's not clear what's you know, reporting and what's an ad that really bothers me. Kim in Contra Costa County. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Kim. Oh, hold on. I got to do it again to you. I'm sorry. I'll put you on hold. We got a great segment coming up with our digital photography guru, Chris Marquardt. And I'll get your question, Kim, too, in just a bit. She's a film student. Wants to buy the best laptop for her. That's coming up. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hey, if you are getting ready for the new iPhone, so is Gazelle. Gazelle's the place I bring all my old gadgets, old phones, old tablets, and sell them for cold, hard cash. Right now, you can bring your iPhone to Gazelle, and they'll lock in the price until the iPhone comes out, and then some. That's pretty sweet. Gazelle. Sell your iPhone for cash. The old iPhone, get the new iPhone. You're guaranteed for that price for 30 days. So now's the time. I can tell you, somebody asked in the chat room, well, is my iPhone getting more valuable? No. When's the best time to get a quote? Now. Because I guarantee you, none of this stuff is gaining in value. And as soon as they announce a new iPhone, it's going to drop even faster. So visit gazelle.com. Get all your stuff in here, you know, get quotes on everything. And then when you decide, okay, time to pull the trigger, I got the new iPhone, for instance, then what you do is you check out and they'll send you a box, prepaid, postage, and everything. You just put it right in the box, send it to them. They'll turn it around fast. If you forget to wipe the data, they'll do it. And they'll send you cash, PayPal. You can get a check or a PayPal credit. Or, and I like this, if you're an Amazon user, get that Amazon gift card because you get 5% more. Really great customer service. 1.5 million trade-ins for over $100 million. It's really a great deal. Actually, they've paid nearly $170 million now over to 1 million customers at Gazelle. Take that old gadget, that old iPhone. Get ready for the new iPhone, the new iPad at Gazelle. Gazelle.com. Gazelle. Chris Marquardt is here, digital photography guru. He is did you know that Adam Curry's first podcast was 10 years ago this week?
I did listen to that back then. Absolutely.
So did I. Who didn't? And when did you start Tips from the Top Floor, your podcast about photography?
In April 2005.
So you're a bit later. You're an original. A pioneer.
Still kind of a pioneer. I wish I would have started in 2004, but I didn't find out about podcasting until I think early April 2005, and then it took about a couple of weeks for me to get on board because it was wonderful.
Well, I was lucky because we were already distributing this radio show on the internet. I mean, just putting audio MP3s up. So when I first heard about podcasting, which was around September 2004, I said, well, I can do a podcast. I already have the files. I just make a feed. So we started
podcasting. And it's
seeing
and it's getting a bit of a resurgence right now. I'm seeing lots of new clients come out and lots of people getting into podcasting who haven't even thought about it. There's kind of a new generation coming up, I think.
Good. I pretty much make my living besides being a radio broadcaster as a podcaster during the week. So, Chris, what do you want to talk about today? You have some photographic myth-busting for us?
I have one more thing. Well, I want to complete something. About 2 weeks ago, we talked about filters. You might remember, protect your lens from dings and things. The UV filter that you don't really need when you have a digital camera. Those filters are already in there. And then we ended on the note that you don't need filters, but I got quite some feedback about this because there are actually some filters out there that you can make use of and that are very, very helpful. So I want to briefly talk about a few filters when you have a digital camera that are actually very useful.
All right.
Do you use any filters?
I have a neutral density filter.
Good. Let's start with that one. Okay. Neutral density filter. is pretty much, I always say it's a bit, it's like sunglasses for your camera. It makes everything darker. So imagine you're out there in the sun and you want to shoot a waterfall and you want to get streaks of water. You want to show the motion in the water. But in the sunlight, that's just not possible or not easily possible, because you will, with all this light, you will probably work with pretty short shutter speeds. Your camera will kind of go into whatever, 1/1000 to 2/2000 of a second. So you freeze that water. You don't get any motion in there. And an ND filter can help you get that. An ND filter can help you simply get less light in the camera. So something has to give. And in one case, it could be the shutter speed. So you expose longer. The other thing that you might change to get more light into the camera is open up the aperture. And what that does is that it gives you less depth of field. It gives you nicer blurry backgrounds in portraits, for example. So if you are out in the sun, that's the other problem, that you usually shoot with a pretty small aperture. So everything tends to be in focus. So an ND filter can kind of open up the creative side of photography for you. So they come at different strengths. So some are darker, some are less dark. Go online, Google ND filter or neutral density filter. There are lists of how strong they are and what they do.
I think mine is a couple of stops, three stops maybe. I can't remember.
Yeah, 2-3 stops, and then you can stack them, right. Even though that adds reflections. But sometimes I do that. I stack them to get like really long exposure times. There's a variation of that, and it's called an ND grad, which means graduated ND filter. And it doesn't mean it was at university. It means it is. It has a gradient in the middle. So it's like, you know, the front of your windshield, it's dark on the top and then transparent where you look through. And between those, there's a gradient. And the ND grad filter is pretty much the same thing. You have a dark top half and a bottom half that's transparent. And what that is used for is to darken down bright skies. So you might have a very strong bright sky and then a darker landscape in the foreground. And the camera kind of has a bit of trouble sometimes to get both of those well exposed at the same time. So with an ND grad filter, you can darken down that sky and kind of even out the brightness in the picture.
Nowadays, people shoot HDR, high dynamic range, to solve that. They shoot a bright one and a dark one and they mix them together. They edit it in Photoshop.
Which is true. Yeah, but then ND grad filter kind of lets you do this in camera. You can pretty much get this whole thing in one shot.
I also have a polarizing filter. Is that a good thing to have? Circular polarizing, I think, is what it is.
Circular. Well, first of all, there are linear polarizers and circular polarizers. If you want to get a polarizer, I would suggest recommend a circular polarizer, because sometimes the linear polarizers get the exposure system a bit in trouble. So a circular polarizer is always the recommendation there. And what the polarizer does is it helps you get more contrast in the colors, more color saturation. And the way it does it is it removes reflections. Like if you look at a tree, the leaves reflect the blue sky and that takes the green out of the tree. So depending on how shiny those leaves are, if you use a polarizing filter, you can remove those reflections. And you can remove reflections on water and on glass as well. So if you want to shoot fish in a pond, a polarizer is your friend. If you want to shoot through car windows without those reflections on the front window, a polarizer is going to help you there. It just does not work for metal reflections, just on glass and water and other surfaces. It can even help you cut down some glare if you're in the mountains or if you want to shoot in the distance. There are particles in there. There's dust and water particles in the air, and those also reflect light. So that's one of the reasons you see the glare in the distance when everything kind of turns bluish. That's pretty much the sky reflecting in those particles, and a polarizer can help you take some of that out. So you get you see a bit further with a polarizer as well. It also takes light away. So if you are indoors, a polarizer might take up to 2 stops away, and might not be the best idea to use that indoors. It's usually something you use outdoors. And one last filter, if you want to see the world with very different eyes, there is what's called an infrared pass-through filter. So that's a filter that lets infrared light through, and that is light that we don't see with our eyes. So it looks like a black filter. You can't see through it because it doesn't let visual light through it, but it lets infrared light through, and some cameras are sensitive to infrared, and then you get the picture in a way that maybe some insects see the world. It's it makes you have to expose very long because it cuts out most of the visible light, but the world looks very different in infrared light. For example, green trees all of a sudden look like they have snow on them. A green lawn is like snow. Colors are just very different in the infrared world, and that is that's quite exciting and quite a different way to look at things.
So you don't need it to protect your lens, and certainly that UV or haze filter they try to sell you at the camera store.
Yeah, I stand by that. You don't need those to protect your lens, no. But no. Get a lens hood, and that will not only help you get more contrast in your pictures, but it helps you if you bang the camera against something.
Yeah,
it'll just keep things off the front of your lens. Yeah.
So is there any excuse for having a haze filter? I mean, is there a reason you would need that?
Well, there are a few exceptions. Some lenses, for example, that claim to be waterproof or water or splash-proof, like professional lenses, are only splash-proof if you have a protective filter on the front.
Oh.
So if you go,
but there's no
to the
optical.
Beach,
a haze filter doesn't do anything to the picture optically.
No.
In fact, all glass is a UV filter.
There's one that's called the skylight filter. What that does, it adds a little warm tint to the picture. So it changes the color, and you can do this in digital.
I don't like to use filters too much unless I can't get the shot, as the case of the neutral density, where it's just so bright I can't, you know, turn down the shutter speed, things like that. Hey, Chris, is that Tips from the Top Floor or discoverlightroom.com? Don't forget our assignment, which is... We don't remember. But we'll find out.
Wait.
No, we're out of time. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, right after this. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Our photo assignment, Chris Marquardt does this every month, and it's not a competition. There's no prizes or anything. But we invite you to take a picture illustrating a word or a concept, and then upload that picture to Flickr and to our tech guy group. This month, Chris has asked everybody to do a picture that illustrates the word, the idea, the concept upside down. Upside down. And we've already got some interesting submissions. So take a picture. It's just an excuse to get out there and take a picture. In fact, our moderator, Renee Silverman, is always putting up additional assignments and so forth. So it's really a lot of fun. The Tech Guy group, if you go to Flickr.com, it's free to join. It's a Yahoo site, so if you have a Yahoo account, you already have a Flickr account. And then look for the Tech Guy group. You can find it because there's 11,515 members, 3,789 photos. That means some of you have not submitted photos yet. Get to work. It's all right. Camera phone's fine. Kim has been very patient. Thank you, Kim, for hanging on from Contra Costa. You're a film student.
Yes, I am. Thank you so much for taking my call.
My pleasure. Thanks for holding on. That's exciting. What kind of films do you want to make?
I want to direct feature films, start maybe with indies and just work with comedic dramas. That's my forte.
Have you done some already, just, you know, independently for yourself?
Not too many. I've done little short submissions
and shorts,
stuff, but nothing too big. I don't really have professional equipment, and this is why I'm going to film school, so that I can really learn all the tricks and trades.
How exciting. Well, what can I help you with?
Well, I've been looking because my laptop is about to die, and I need a new one, and one that has a good processor, good specs, and somewhat affordable. I have a decent range of what I can get, but I was looking recently at the Microsoft Surface Pro 3, and I was told that it had enough power to do film editing. And also, I like that it's kind of a combination. I can take notes on this. There's so much I can do with it, and it's compact, and I can take it anywhere. But the downside is there's no CD drive. I'd have to buy that, and so I could make.
Yeah, most laptops nowadays do not come with drives because that is something you probably will never do again.
Yeah.
Even as a film student, I doubt very much. But it's, you know, any laptop with a USB port, you can get an external drive. And that's probably fine because you don't want to have that extra weight with you all the time, just when you need it.
Oh, yeah, no.
External drives are not very expensive. I'm not a huge fan of Windows for anybody at all because I just think it's a terrible operating system. It's hard to use. It's full of bugs. And it's a attack surface for bad guys. So I generally try to keep people away from Windows. The same amount of money you'd end up spending for a Surface Pro 3, by the time you add the $129 keyboard, you could get a Mac, MacBook Air. Is there some reason you don't want to get a Mac?
I do. I have been interested in Mac in the past. I've never had a Mac. That's the only thing.
I understand. Yeah.
I am interested in Mac, and I have looked at it. And
the Surface Pro is expensive, and I don't really understand Microsoft's thinking, because they're competing against Windows laptops that are half or less. And so it just doesn't make a lot of sense to me. They're trying to compare it to a Macintosh, but you know what? If you're at that price point, get a Macintosh, especially if you're a film student. Now, here's what I want you to do. I want you to talk to the school, see what they recommend. Okay.
Yeah, the thing is, they use PCs. They don't use Macs. They tell me, laptops, it doesn't matter what you have. We use PCs, but you can have a Mac. And then the person who I talk to, they have a Mac, and they like their Mac. So it's all...
Yeah. I mean, you can... Are they... What software are they using? Adobe Premiere, it must be, if they're using Windows.
They're using Avid.
Avid. Oh. Well, then maybe you do have to get a PC.
Well, you can use Avid on a Mac as well. I'm just... The reason I like the Surface Pro 3 is because I can use it not just for film editing. I would be able to take notes in class. I don't have to buy a bunch of notebooks, and I can... I love the pen thing that you can just write on the screen and stuff. I really enjoy that.
You're the best possible candidate for it. Just remember that you're going to have to pay for the keyboard additionally. They don't sell that touch keyboard anymore. Thank goodness. That was a terrible keyboard. They sell the type keyboard. The Surface I have to say, it's a great tablet. If you use one, it'd be good for a student, because you could use the stylus in OneNote to take notes in class as if you're writing them in a notebook. Lots to be said for that. Since you're using Avid, it doesn't matter if you get a Mac or a PC. In fact, if the school uses PCs, that's an argument for using PCs. Not because you need one, but because there'll be a lot of people around you who understand Windows and who can help you.
Yeah.
I'm stunned to hear a film school using Windows, to be honest with you. But, nowadays it's true. In fact, our editors are all now moving to PCs because Apple, has not really kept up with the times, unfortunately, with Final Cut. Avid is kind of what's used probably most of all in
the industry standard.
In the industry, yeah. So I think a Surface Pro 3 is a very good choice. If you wanted to look around, maybe look at the Lenovo's, the Carbon X1 Touch. You definitely want, if you're going to use Windows 8.1, you want a touch machine. It really works better with touch. There are, similar hardware for less. But because it's Microsoft, I feel like you're kind of buying, you're buying a known quantity. So I think I can't really recommend against it. I think it's a very nice, if you're going to get Windows, it's a very nice choice.
So go ahead
and get it. Now, you can get it now in the i7 variant. Unknown whether you'll need that. The other problem you're going to face is video takes up a lot of space, and there's not a lot of storage on any of these.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So
yeah,
you probably get an external drive. You should absolutely ask the school if they have a student discount. If you get it through the school bookstore, they probably do.
Mm-hmm.
That'll save you maybe 10%, 15%.
I know a lot of the stores, they have these student discounts where they give you $100 off. But
yeah. Yeah, you can usually get a deal. I think as long as the school supports Windows, which they do, and you are very clearly very happy with Windows, you make a very strong case for the stylus and the OneNote, which really, in many ways, the Surface Pro is a OneNote machine. It's kind of designed for that. So you make a good case for that. And you've used Windows, so you know what you're getting into. Have you used Windows 8 yet?
I don't believe I have. I haven't.
That's
from 2007.
Yeah, you haven't. You'll have to get... There'll be a little getting used to it. Although, since you're using a touch device, a tablet, it'll probably be all right. Yeah, get the Surface. And then get an external drive, because you're probably not going to do a lot of editing on the Surface anyway, are you? You could probably go into the labs to do the editing.
Yeah, I plan that I'm going to use the labs anyway to do most of the work. But if I want to work at home, or like the project that I have to do before school starts, I want to have a laptop that I can kind of at least work with.
So make sure you get an external, fast external drive, because you're not going to have much storage on that Surface. And then you can get an external DVD burner as well.
Okay, thank you
all right.
so much.
Hey, enjoy. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Good luck in school. I'll look for your first feature.
All right.
Thanks, Kim. See you later. Website techguylabs.com. That'll have links to all the stuff I mentioned. Also a link to our chat room. I haven't mentioned the chat room lately. Great place. 838 people in the chat room right now. Just kind of the kids in the back of the class talking back to me, throwing virtual spitballs, but also they're kind of my brain externalized. They help me out quite a bit. If you want to get in the chat room, please, we invite you to do so. It's moderated, so it's family friendly. Just go to techguylabs.com for the link and all the show notes. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Well, hey, 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 how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the tech guy. Time to talk computers, the internet, cell phones, camcorders, MP3 players, and all that jazz. 8888 Ask Leo, that's the phone number. If you want to talk tech, I want to talk with you. Our website, techguylabs.com. It's where you'll find links to all the show notes, audio and video of the shows after the fact, all 1,110 of them. Podcasts, too, if you like to download and play for later. I like to think of that as audio and video on demand. You know what I'm saying. We also have a great chat room, which I mentioned earlier. Now, lots of people in there chatting away. Have a good time in there. Rob on the line from Sylmar, California. Hey, Rob. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hi, Leo. Love your show.
Thank you so much.
I have a problem. I have running Windows 7 on a Lenovo desktop and have no issues with it normally. And I'm also running Office, the 2007 version, which is good enough for me. I'm a struggling writer and blogger, so I don't need to upgrade.
In fact, I think most of us would be hard pressed to tell you what the difference is between 2007 and 2013.
Right.
I mean, really, a word processor is a word processor, and has been for a long time. Yeah.
So it works fine, or it has. About a couple of weeks ago, we had a massive power failure in the neighborhood.
Uh-oh.
The power was out for about 12 hours, and everything seemed to be okay when you know the power was restored, except whenever I run either Word or Excel, it takes like 5 minutes, and it keeps running the notice that it's configuring the program.
Yeah, Word and Excel hate power failures.
Really?
No. So you may be right, though. You may be onto something with the power failure. Usually it's not the power failure that causes the problem. It could be if you were when the power went out, were you working away on your computer?
Yeah, I had both programs open.
Oh, okay. There you go. So a couple of things can happen. You know, if you were just using your computer and you reach over and you unplug it,
mm-hmm.
If you do it at the wrong time, such as when the hard drive is writing data out, you could cause major problems. That data suddenly gets, you know, kind of dumped, spewed. Then there's also the problem when the power comes back. So if, you know, you had a UPS or some sort of battery backup and the power went out, the computer's still running, you go, oh, I better shut down. You shut it down. When the power comes back, there's usually a spike, a surge of power. It's as if, you know, the power company's got a giant hose and they suddenly turn it on and it goes whoosh and rushes through your house.
Well, I actually turned off all my circuit breakers.
Yeah, smart. When you have a power failure, it's a good idea to unplug devices, throwing the circuit breakers. Circuit breakers may or may not help because if that surge is sufficient, it'll jump the circuit breaker.
Oh, really?
Yeah, believe it or not. But you're on the right track, and that's certainly a good precaution because you don't want those surges. That could damage a lot of stuff. Your home theater stuff, your stereo, your TV, and your computer.
I had knocked off all my circuit breakers.
Good man.
I didn't have any other obvious issues.
Well, here's the thing. You're running along. You're using
the data that I was working on was fine. I was able.
Yeah.
It had auto recovery, and I had everything.
No, I know, but it's what was happening that very millisecond that the power went out. Maybe you were saving your configuration data. Because it's doing that all the time, and that configuration file got corrupted. So
you know, I have the original disks, and I figured, well, I'll just do a repair from that.
Yes.
And that didn't work.
That's what I would have suggested. Oh, that's a shame.
And what I was getting a weird error message saying that it couldn't find a file.
Yeah.
Like the disk was corrupt.
Yeah.
I have two Office 2007 disks. I tried both. I even tried copying it onto the hard drive because I know sometimes that works. I was able to find on the internet that that was a known issue back when 2007 was introduced. And what they said was to install the trial version first and then do the upgrade. But I figure the 2007 trial version isn't likely to be available.
Good luck finding it, yeah.
Yeah, in 2014.
So here...
And then I get that configuration every time I open the program, and then also sometimes right in the middle of working, it'll just come on. So it's very annoying.
Yeah, I think you have a damaged file, and it's trying to write to the file. That's what happens, by the way. That config file is constantly opened and saved and closed. So here's another scenario you might imagine. Power goes off right as that hard drive is writing that file, and the head crashes. Because the power, normally these hard drives, by the way, they have enough juice. When the power goes out, they retract the head and protect the disk. But if the head crashed onto the disk, which it sounds like it might have, and actually put a ding in the disk, then you can never write to that sector again. The operating system is not smart enough to relocate that data. It knows where the data is. It doesn't see the ding. So that's could be a perfect explanation for why you're having this problem and why it's so difficult to fix. The configuration file's there. Everybody knows it's there. What they don't see is that there's a big chunk missing out of the middle. So you were right to do the repair. That's probably the correct thing to do. The good news is your data's safe. If all you lost is a configuration file, you're lucky. You do have a good backup. I'm going to count on that. You probably should go out now and get a new hard drive, external hard drive. Put all your you're a writer. You don't want to lose that stuff. Put all that important stuff, the documents you created, on another disk outside of the computer. If you don't have Carbonite, this would be a good time to get Carbonite. Get that stuff outside of the computer. And now what we want to do is probably uninstall Office completely. Try a fresh install. If you still have the problem, which I don't think you will, you're going to want to run you've got two choices. You can either spend $90 on SpinWrite, which is a program that will go through your entire hard drive sector by sector and look for things like, I can't read this sector. There must be a dent in it. And when it finds stuff like that, what SpinWrite does, it'll read it and read it and read it until it can't, until, you know, the cows come home, get whatever data it can off there. Eventually, it will say, okay, this is bad, and it'll mark that unusable. Then the next time you install Windows and Office, it'll say, I'm not going to write to that sector. It's unusable. All hard drives have a significant number of bad sectors. It's called a bad sector table. Coming from the factory, when they first make the hard drive, they test it. They find the bad sectors, and they make a table. All hard drives have this table that says, don't use that sector. That's bad. So you're just going to add a new sector to the bad sector table, and Office and Windows and everything else will ignore it, won't use it. It's not available. It's not part of the hard drive space. Sometimes when people run SpinWrite, they'll notice that their drive has shrunk by a few megabytes or less. Those are bad sectors marked off. Now, the problem is SpinWrite's as expensive as a brand new disk. So I suspect a lot of people just go, yeah, I bet this is bad. I'm going to buy a new one, put it in, use that instead. So first thing to do always, though, back up that data, back up that writing. You don't want to lose that. And then try reinstalling Office. If that doesn't work, then maybe you want to get a new drive or SpinWrite the drive and just checking it. My suspicion is that there is actually disk damage in that config file, and Office continues to try to write to it and fails. It's not enough for Office to give up. Office isn't going to say, I give up. I can't work any longer. I can't work under these conditions. It's just going to say, couldn't write the configuration. Let me try that next time and next time and next time. I'm acting as if there's one config file. There's a number of places that Office needs to write to save your configuration. And any one of them could be damaged. It's kind of hard to tell. I think probably a new hard drive is in order. But first things first, uninstall and reinstall Office. Judy in Placentia, California. Hi, yes. Judy.
Uh-huh. Welcome. Hi.
What can I do for you?
Well, is this Lee?
Oh, this is he. Yes, you're on the radio.
I am. Okay. I called twice. Yeah, actually, I called three times yesterday, and the last two times you couldn't hear me. But anyway, what I'd like to know is I have never had a smartphone. I do have a cell phone, but I'm 7 years old, and I don't catch on to these things as quickly as the young kids do. So what I would like to know is your input on whether I should get an iPhone.
Hang on, and I'm going to help you buy your first smartphone right after this. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. I'll stand by you. Yes, sirree. I'll stand by Judy right now in Placentia. Poor Judy. We tried to get her on the phone three times yesterday. Couldn't get her. I'm so glad I got you back.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad I could get through again. Thank you.
First smartphone. Now, let me ask you a few questions so I can better serve you.
Okay.
You understand I have no dog in this hunt. I use all the smartphones out there I've used. Who's your carrier and do you want to stay with them?
Well, right now I'm with T-Mobile and have been for 6 years, and I love their service.
I love them too, and I'd stay with them.
Well, my only question is, though, my husband and I are going to do some a road trip. We're going to drive from California to North Carolina to see my son, and then up to Michigan.
Fun.
And we don't get real good service at my son's in North Carolina, and I'm just a little worried about the coverage, being able to get.
Yeah.
Good coverage.
Generally in Southern California, Verizon is the best, and I would bet in North Carolina, too. Everybody says AT&T has the best data speeds. But I'm a T-Mobile fan mostly because they're the little underdogs, and I'm rooting for them. You know what
I'm
saying?
Right, yeah. Yeah, it's just the only because my son lives out in the country, and I can't get a signal there at all. Now, maybe...
What does your son use?
Phone I might be able to.
No. What does your son use?
He has... Oh, goodness. I think he's either got Verizon or the U-verse.
Okay.
Like
so you ask him what he uses and whether it works well. And
okay.
You're in an area where you could probably use anybody.
Exactly. Yeah.
So if connectivity in Carolina is more important than that, I would ask him what works.
Okay.
But the truth is, all the carriers have pretty much all the phones, so that's not going to matter too much.
Uh-huh.
And you're going to a smartphone just because you want to keep up with the times, or is there particular that attracts you?
Yeah, basically what I want to use it for, talking, of course. I want a GPS for when we're traveling.
Yeah.
Email, just the different apps.
It's going to be your computer on this road trip.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
That's a good reason. And by the way, that's really what's happened is that, and one of the reasons these screens keep getting bigger is people are starting to make these their primary computer, aren't they? They don't.
Exactly.
Know. Now, when is the trip? Soon?
Next month.
Because you know that Apple announces its new iPhone September 9th.
Okay.
And the other phone I might recommend for you, the Motorola X, will be updated September 4th.
Yeah. Now, are you saying that I should get the older model because the newer model is coming out?
Or? No, I mean, you generally want to get the new model.
Okay, gotcha.
Unless you're trying to save money. The other reason you might care about the new model coming out is because the older model usually is discounted.
Uh-huh.
But that won't happen till then.
Okay, uh-huh.
So you could either save money or get the latest, greatest.
Uh-huh. Well, I'm not leaving until the middle of September, and then, of course, once I get back there, my son will be able to show me how to use it and everything, so and we know our way here in North Carolina.
Yeah. What does your son use?
I'm sorry?
What does your son use?
Goodness. You know,
is he an iPhone?
Years, I'm not sure.
The only reason that's possibly relevant is he can help you. If it's an iPhone, if he uses an iPhone, then he'll be more likely to be able to help you with your iPhone.
Gotcha.
So you might ask him. I mean, here's some homework for you.
Okay.
Call him and say, hey, okay, son, what do you use? What's your carrier? Chat room's saying the Outer Banks anyway, that Verizon's pretty good out there.
Yeah. No, he's near Charlotte.
He's near Charlotte. Oh, you know, near Charlotte, probably anything.
Yeah.
And then ask him, what do you have, son? Do you like it?
Yeah.
I think for most first-time smartphone buyers, an iPhone is a pretty much a no-brainer choice. You can't really go wrong.
Okay.
Because you're buying kind of the state-of-the-art stuff, and it's well-supported. Apple has very good training. They have a program called One-on-One where you go in the morning to the Apple store, and it's just you and an Apple genius, and they take an hour, and they're very patient, and they sit with you, and they work right through all the features. It's great. I highly recommend it.
Okay.
No, nobody else will do anything as good as that. So that's where Apple really excels.
Uh-huh.
I'm a pretty happy user of Android, but I'm a geek and I like to configure things and play with things. That you don't care about that.
Yeah, no, I don't.
Uh-uh. You may now. Is your eyesight pretty good?
Yeah, I forgot my glasses on.
All right. So the size of the screen, you don't need to have a bigger screen because
I love my son has the that new Galaxy. Whatever it is, the bigger one.
Oh, okay. So he is an Android user. All right.
And this is my other son. And I love it, but I want something I can stick in my pocket. Because a lot of times I don't like to carry my purse. And
right.
I just,
well, the iPhone will be a good choice. I think this Motorola X, probably it'll be called the X Plus One, will also be a very good choice. I think it's a very elegant, nicely done phone. Both of them are 4.7 inches.
Okay,
that's a good size. Now, you could go bigger. The Note 4, the Samsung Galaxy Note 4 comes out in the next couple of weeks. That's going to be 6 inches.
Oh, wow.
But I think that's probably bigger than you want. It sounds like it's bigger than you want.
I think so. Now,
how about the camera? Is the camera important to you?
Yes. That was another thing.
Go with the iPhone.
I mean, we have a nice camera, so it's not like, but here's I do want to be able to just snap up pictures and send them off,
the
too.
The only frustration with the iPhone that I find is it doesn't have a removable battery, and so it doesn't often. People use it so much. You'll use it so much because it's going to be everything for you. It doesn't. It runs out of juice before a full day. So you're going to be in the car. You're going to want a car charger for it. That's not such a big deal.
Okay.
And you may want to buy, and you'll know after you use it for a while, an external battery that you could charge it with later. Sometimes people buy something called a Mophie case, M-O-P-H-I-E. This is a case that has a battery. It doubles the life.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So a lot of people find that battery life on the iPhone leaves a little bit desired, frankly.
Okay, gotcha.
And so, you know,
Mophie is for the...
it's a case for the iPhone that you put it in, and then when you run out of juice on the iPhone, you flip a switch. Do you remember the Volkswagen Bugs where they had that?
We had one.
Yeah, it has a reserve tank. You flip this. They didn't have a gas gauge, so you didn't know. You'd run out of gas. You'd flip the. This is just like that. You flip the switch, and now you got more juice for your phone.
I know. I got myself in trouble with my husband one time because I flipped it and forgot to tell him.
We'd flip it and we'd forget, and then you don't have a reserve tank anymore.
Right.
Well, I'm glad. See, there we go. Now we've connected culturally.
Yeah.
So I think for the first smartphone, an iPhone's great. If you can wait until they announce the new one, the problem is they're going to announce it on the 9th. You probably won't be able to get one until the 19th, which is a little late for you.
Yeah. Okay, that's doable.
You know, all right. I would wait and see.
Back there, too.
I will wait and see because they're going to do some, you know, they always improve it slightly. I think the camera might be a little bit better, things like that. You can't go wrong buying an iPhone. You really can't. So I think that's going to be the right one for you, Judy. Enjoy your trip. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. A couple of people were saying, why didn't you tell Judy to get a Windows phone? And certainly Windows phone. The big negative on Microsoft's Windows Phone 8.1 is the App Store, the lack of apps that you might find or expect on Android or an iPhone. So if you've never used a smartphone, that probably wouldn't bother you, right? You'd feel perfectly at ease. If you get a Nokia Windows Phone, the Here Maps, the navigation's pretty good, quite good. I find, though, the lack of Google apps on Windows Phone really bugs me. That's the big one, the lack of Google Maps, Google Plus, Google Music, all the things I use a lot of Google services. They're on the iPhone. They're on Android, of course, but they aren't on Windows Phone. Windows Phone is beautiful. It's a lovely interface. Well done. It's hard for me to recommend it. I don't want somebody, especially for their first smartphone, to be painted into a corner, into a dead end. And I feel like at this point, it's a dead end, alas. Sorry, Microsoft. 1% adoption rate in the U.S. is just not going to do it. Tim in Cape Cod, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Tim.
Hey, Leo. Good afternoon. I am a longtime addicted listener, first-time caller.
Thank you. Welcome.
Hey, I've been struggling for a little bit now trying to improve my rendering speeds and doing my encoding for CS6 and also another application, ProShow Producer by Photodex.
Okay.
When I'm in the edit bay and you're playing around there, completely content, everything's working fine. But I'm just growing beards when it comes to rendering.
Are you a video editor?
Yes.
How interesting. There's a lot of work in Cape Cod for video editors?
Well, when you volunteer to do one wedding, you get about 600
a year, so. Smart man, yeah. Very smart. So what do you use? You're using Premiere, I guess, if you're using
using the CS6, okay. Which was a nice little bite out of the hobby budget. But
yeah, no kidding. And, render speeds on a lot of Adobe's products are conditional, not just on CPU speed. Here's the thing. You need to figure out what is the bottleneck. Is it memory? Is it hard drive? Is it CPU speed? Or is it GPU speed, the graphics processor? And it could be any of the four or even a combination of all of them. Obviously, if you've got an SSD, a fast drive that's really easy, swift to read, that's going to help a little bit. If you have a lot of RAM so it can load data in larger chunks, that's going to help a little bit. The problem is you can't always know whether the processes that you use are CPU bound, the processor is the slowdown, or GPU bound, the graphics card is the slowdown. And it does depend, I believe. I know that most of the Adobe products now will use the graphics processor, so a faster video card certainly will make a difference.
Yeah, I was just, and doing the web research, I kind of, you referenced a little bit about what you said earlier about being careful what you read, because half of the review sites are simply advertisements.
Yeah, boy, isn't that amazing? And it's getting worse.
It is, it is.
And harder to tell.
I think I've narrowed down some of the things. I built an i7 920. It's a little old, but still pretty spiffy for the applications. I put a solid-state drive in it with a SATA 3.
So you've addressed two of those issues, the disk I.O. and the CPU speed.
Yep, and 16 gig of RAM.
And you got lots of RAM, although 16 is kind of the minimum for what you're doing.
Yeah, and while I'm working in production and stuff, it very seldom ever hits the hard drive because I'm working mostly out of the RAM.
You have enough memory now; that's not an issue.
Right, but man,
it's GPU. Then it's definitely the graphics processor.
Yeah, yeah. So, I hear things. Again, I'm just getting some conflicting information about the CUDA processing and whether or not Adobe can put his hooks really into the GPUs that are out there. Some can, some can't. And
It also is different processes might use the CPU or versus the GPU. It's hard to, they don't really tell you.
Yeah.
When you say rendering, at what stage? You mean converting it to the final file format?
Yeah, encoding for output, encoding to MP4.
Okay, so that's different than, say, adding a blur, which would absolutely be GPU. My experience, and this is going to depend on the software, that the encoding, converting it to MP4, I think the CPU could make a big difference on it.
Okay.
I think it's not going to be the graphics card. I think your fastest now, but I'm looking at Burke and other people in our office just to see. Maybe the chat room has an idea. I wish they should really make. Maybe there is somewhere on Adobe's site just a list of all the different things and whether the CPU is needed or the GPU or is needed for this. Certainly, a lot of stuff the graphics processor makes a difference.
Yeah.
But I'm thinking encoding a video, which is basically compressing it. Is a CPU issue.
Yeah. But the other confusing thing is I can look at the task manager and the CPU load while it's exporting, and it's just fluttering along. It's not getting hit to the rail or anything like that there. So I just can't tell where it's getting choked at this point. And obviously you don't have any diagnostic tools to see what the GPU is doing.
Well, that's telling. I mean, if the GPU, if you're looking at how the GPU is getting, the CPU is getting used and it's not 100%, then that's not the bottleneck, is it?
Yeah, yeah. Such is life. Well, I can just continue to shave every day and stay up that way. So,
yeah, that's why God made coffee.
That's right.
Go have a cup of coffee.
Enough of that.
He knew there'd be people sitting there watching the screen, and that coffee would be the solution.
And Twit TV.
And Twit TV. Maybe a faster video card will help. I don't know, and it might be worth looking at that. One of the things I do know is that hardware nowadays can have built-in hardware encoders for MPEG-4. What kind of video card do you have right now?
I've got an NVIDIA GeForce with 1 gig of RAM on that.
And which GeForce?
Well, you would have to ask.
That's an easy thing to upgrade. Not cheap, but it is an easy thing to upgrade. Okay. So you've done. I would have thought the CPU, but since you're telling me that the when you look at the process, it's not using 100% of the cycles. Is it using all the CPU? You have four CPUs on this on that thing.
It's actually using 8 cores.
It's using all 8.
Yep.
Yeah, you know, chat room's recommending a really great program from Microsoft. Mark Rusinovich's Process Explorer will tell you which processes are using which hardware.
Yep.
So try Process Explorer. Take a look. I'm thinking at this point, since you've sped up everything, it is the graphics processor, and you want one that has hardware, video, and coding built into it.
Great. I've shotgunned everything else. That's the last one.
Yeah. Yeah. You narrowed it down for me.
Yeah. Leo, thanks so much, man. It's you have a great show, great diversity, and a great staff.
Well, you get the Geek Question of the Week award, so.
All right.
Congratulations,
Tim. Much.
Thank you for listening. I appreciate it. It's worth going into a little bit because it is important to understand that when you say, why is my machine slow? A lot of people say, well, I have a slow processor, and just assume that's doing all the work. That's doing all the thinking. But really, the speed of your machine is a factor of all of the parts of the machine. The speed of I/O is absolutely important. The I/O input output, that is the ability to read from the drive quickly and write to the drive quickly, makes a big difference. In many cases, a bigger difference than anything else. How much memory you have is important, because if the data set that you're working on, and this is really true of video and photography, if it's a large chunk of data, it needs to fit into memory for you to operate it on efficiently. If you have to page it in and out of memory, it's going to slow you down quite a bit. So there's a lot of factors in this. Could be slow memory, I guess, huh? 8888 Ask Leo. One more segment to go. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Last few minutes of the Tech Guy show for this week. Don't forget, all week long, I keep doing this same kind of stuff on our podcast network, TWIT, TWIT.TV. It stands for This Week in Tech. We've got shows on Windows, on Mac, on Android, on iPhone, on iPad. We've got news shows. It's all there, TWIT.TV, including this show, which we make available all for free. I believe in free. I like free. Thanks to our fine sponsors, we can give it away. Let's go to Dale in Pomona, California. He's our next caller. Hi, Dale.
Hi, how you doing, Leo?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm doing great. I'm probably the least techie guy you're going to be talking to this year.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's a very high bar you've set for yourself.
Well, I like a challenge. My problem is I've been running XP on my computer that I've had for a while. And obviously in April, Microsoft stopped doing stuff for that. My company offers the Windows 7 as a download.
That's fine.
Now, so being a non-techie, I don't know what I need to do to prepare my computer, take stuff off, put...
Well, it depends first of all, how much stuff that's on your computer you don't want to lose. There's obviously documents you don't want to lose.
Yeah, I have documents, and I have Finale, a Composer program that I have.
You do music?
Yes, I'm a musician.
How cool is that?
It's very cool. It's more of a hobby. I'm actually a teacher by trade.
Great. So the first thing you do is, I hope you're making backups, but if not, here's a great opportunity. Go out and get an external hard drive. Your XP machine has USB ports on it.
Yes, it does.
So you just plug in that external hard. They're cheap. You can go to the big box stores or any computer store. About $100 for a terabyte or two.
Okay.
And which is a lot more than you've got in your computer right now.
Yes.
And just copy everything you need. Copy all your documents. Certainly your Composer and Finale files. Unfortunately, the apps themselves will have to be reinstalled when you get Windows 7.
Okay.
So I hope you've saved the discs.
Yeah. I have my original disc, all that.
Oh, that's good. Probably the best thing to do is to check to see if there's an upgrade for those programs. Do the upgrade. And most programs now, people don't distribute discs anymore. That's what's happened.
Yeah.
And most of this stuff is downloadable. So you'd go to the websites for those programs, and you've got a serial number. See if you need an upgrade, if you have to pay for it. That's an opportunity to do that. You may have to if you're going from XP to 7. Generally, 7 runs better on most machines, even XP machines. It's lighter weight, believe it or not, than XP. So you should have better results. How much RAM is there on that computer? You need 4 gigs. But I'm thinking since you compose music, you probably have that.
Yeah, I think I do. And I'm not techie. I've actually opened it up and added a...
Wow. See, you're not the least techie person I've talked to all year. You're doing all right. You put more RAM in that. That's great.
Yes, I did.
So the idea is when we install 7, we're going to wipe off the drive and start fresh. That's the best way to do it. So
okay.
You want to make a copy of everything that you need because you're going to lose everything that's on that drive. It's also a great opportunity to make backups.
Okay, good. That's I need to take everything out that I want to keep. And because I had another friend tell me just download it, nothing bad will happen.
Well, you can in fact install Windows 7 on top of XP. It's designed to work that way, but I don't find that to be a super good way to do it.
Okay,
it's
well, I'm
always
better.
Yeah, well, you can try if you want to. If you can't, for instance, if you didn't have a copy of the finale disk and you didn't have your serial number and you really needed to keep it, then I would say, well, just install Windows 7 on top of it. Probably it'll work all right. It's always best to use this as an opportunity to do two things, backup and refresh the hard drive by reformatting it and starting over.
Perfect.
Because then you get a nice, clean install of 7, and you're much more likely to have everything working right.
All right, great.
And then when you download that, it'll probably be in what we call an ISO format. It's a disk image format. And you can just search on the web for making a Windows 7 boot disk from that ISO. It's a very simple thing to do.
So I can actually make a boot disk.
Yeah, and if that XP machine will boot from USB, which it might, then the best thing to do is put it on a USB key and just boot to it. But if it won't, then you're going to have to burn a DVD.
Yeah. Okay, great.
I think it's a good way to go, Dale.
Upgrading to the 7 is just over $10 for me from my company. Oh,
it's a great deal, it really is a much improved operating system. You're going to really like it, I think.
Okay, great.
Good. Hey, thanks for the call.
Thank you so much for all the help.
Anytime, Dale. Appreciate it. Sharon in Fontana, California. Hi, Sharon. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hi, Leo.
How are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
Thank you for taking my call.
I'm a first-time caller, and I'm a little nervous.
Oh, don't be nervous. Don't be nervous. What can I do for you? Just us.
Well, I'm going to be staying at my daughter's every week, and I need my Wi-Fi connection for my laptop. And I got on the Internet and was looking it up. I checked with AT&T UVerse, and they want $50 a month for it. Plus, it'll probably run over, or maybe not. It's a 5 gig. So I also found one on the Internet for free download, Wi-Fi Hotspot Creator 2.
No, that won't do it. So you want the hotspot on your phone or tablet, or do you want it in her house?
My laptop.
Your laptop.
Yeah.
So you can go out and get a wireless internet card that works on the phone network, and that gives you Wi-Fi in your laptop. And you take that with you. You don't have to just use it at your daughter's. Anywhere that you're not within reach of your own Wi-Fi, you have Wi-Fi. Everybody makes those, Verizon, AT&T, everybody. Generally speaking, you're going to pay somewhere between $30 and $60 a month for that. You were quoted $50 for 5 gigs. That's about normal. It might be cheaper to set up Wi-Fi at your daughter's. You can go to DSL Extreme or others.
She has one of those devices. But she needs that for her schooling, and she often goes over the time.
Well, maybe it'd be cheaper for both of you if you went to an internet service provider and had her house wired for internet service.
Yeah, well, she can't afford that right now.
But it'd be cheaper for you than buying a card.
For me.
You could set it up and it'd be a nice gift and you would have it. DSL Extreme, I think, is $13 a month for the first year. There's you know, a DSL provider is generally going to be less than that 3G card. And then she's got Wi-Fi all the time. So you save money and she gets the benefit as well.
Oh, so any DSL provider she has...
Is she AT&T?
No.
Well, she should call her local phone
Verizon.
Company. Yeah, Verizon, or call DSL Extreme. They're our sponsor. And ask, and they have the very low cost starter fees that will get you set up for a year. Whenever you do that, though, look at the contract, see what you're committed to. Some of them have early termination fees. They may be charging you for the equipment stuff. But generally speaking, landline internet service like that is always less expensive than using a modem, a 3G modem. The disadvantage is you don't take it with you, but it's going to cost you less, and your daughter's going to get the benefit, too.
Mm-hmm.
How about that?
Yeah.
All right. Well, I got to run, but I thank you for the call, Sharon. I thank you all for listening. Nathan Staten, our musical director, nice job today. Heather Hammond, our phone director, you too. I'll see y'all next week. Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy. Have a great geek week. Well, that's it for the Tech Guy show for today. I'm Leo Laporte. Thank you so much for joining us. Don't forget, the Tech Guy is just the tip of the iceberg. We do nearly 30 shows now on the Twit Netcast Network, and you'll find them all at twit.tv. We talk about Windows on Windows Weekly, Macintosh on MacBreak Weekly, iPad on iPad Today. You get your daily dose of tech news from Tech News Today and our weekly roundtable show, This Week in Tech. It's all at twit.tv. And I'll be back next time with another great Tech Guy podcast. Thanks for joining me. See you next time.